featured story, war with Iran. And we are entering, as we talked about, we are actually halfway into week number 5 of the war, day 32. And our big development for today, as I'm sure you have heard, all the talk, all the rumors, all the press says that this war is about to end imminently. President Trump is giving a primetime address tomorrow, interestingly enough, on April Fool's Day, kind of like not a great sign, not a great omen. That's kind of arguably the worst day, I would say. We're in the middle of this catastrophic war. People are wondering, are we about to invade Iran or are we going to cut our losses? And Trump announces a primetime address on April Fool's Day. How's anyone going to know it's legit? How can anyone believe what he says tomorrow? Is Trump going to give a speech tomorrow and say, the war is over? We don't even want the Strait anymore. April Fool's, how are we going to know? How can anyone actually know? But Trump is giving an address tomorrow, seriously, and everybody suspects that this speech is going to be about how we are drawing down our engagement in Iran. There have been a number of public statements from the Secretary of State, from the Secretary of War, from the White House press office, from Senator Lindsey Graham, from Benjamin Netanyahu. All statements in the past 48 hours, which seem to indicate that there is a lot of pressure in the White House to bring the war to a close. And this is what everybody believes. This is a story from the Wall Street Journal, and this includes a statement from the president as well. It says, quote, President Trump said on Tuesday the U.S. would be leaving Iran in 2 to 3 weeks. Addressing reporters in the Oval Office, Trump said the U.S. has eliminated Iran's nuclear threat. He said it will take 15 to 20 years for them to rebuild what we've done to them. Trump plans to address the nation on the war tomorrow at 9 o'clock Eastern time. Earlier in the day, the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, said the coming days of the conflict would be decisive and that the number of projectiles launched by Iran in the past 24 hours represented the lowest during the war so far. At the same time, the aircraft carrier USS George H.W. Bush and its accompanying warships are deploying to the Middle East, joining 2 other U.S. carrier strike groups in the region. So you're going to have 3 carrier strike groups positioned, I believe, by the end of this week. That is the USS Abraham Lincoln, the Gerald Ford, and the George Bush. That's actually 1 additional carrier from when we started. We started with 2. Now we're going to have 3. And so let's talk about the current state of the conflict. I'm not going to go through all the background. I think everybody's aware of the facts at this point. As you know, we are stuck in this bear trap. We are caught in a stalemate. The decisive 4-day operation to collapse Iran's government with a decisive strike failed. We are now in an attritional war, which is depleting our munitions, standoff weapons, missile defense systems. Iran is successfully targeting U.S. radar, U.S. bases, strategic U.S. aircraft like an E-3 Sentry, which was destroyed earlier in the week and which cannot be replaced, which we don't. We only have about 12 of those and we don't make them anymore. We don't know how to make them anymore. And that is not even mentioning the biggest problem in this attritional war, which is not even the economical problem of our slow defense supply chains, the fact that we have been rendered vulnerable to Iranian drones and ballistic missiles, which has caused significant losses of U.S. military hardware and infrastructure. But the biggest problem, as everybody knows, is this global energy crunch, which has resulted from Iran's closure of the Strait of Hormuz. And make no mistake about it. Let's say this, and I don't know that I've said it explicitly to date in my coverage of the Iran war, and if I have, I haven't said it enough. Understand that this represents an actual territorial gain for the Islamic Republic of Iran. Consider that last year, when we engaged Iran in negotiations in the summer, we were looking to negotiate on their nuclear program. and maybe their missiles and their proxies. It was the same framework in February when we re-engaged Iran in negotiations again. Well, consider that whether we end the conflict this week or whether we escalate the conflict to win, consider that we have no ability to leverage Iran on any of those issues. Obviously, if we walk away now, we will not have meaningfully imposed restrictions on Iran's support for its proxies, on Iran's missile program, or on Iran's nuclear program. And those were the three issues of contention. Those were the three big files or big areas that were subject to debate last year and last month. What has changed is that Iran has actually expanded its strategic posture in the Middle East. When we say that Iran has closed the Strait of Hormuz, what we are talking about is that they are using drones and missiles to prevent allied Gulf country commercial shipping from leaving the strait. So if a Saudi, Kuwaiti, Emirati, Qatari container ship or chemical tanker tries to leave the strait, it will come under attack by Iran. And because the strait is so narrow, it will surely be hit. And so these vessels are not being insured. So there's a very good chance it will be sunk. And so a lot of them don't want to take the risk because they don't want to die and they don't want to lose the cargo. And also the cargo is not going to be insured. So you've got all these ships stuck on the other side. And Iran is effectively now exercising a veto over which ships can leave and which ships will remain stuck inside the Persian Gulf. Now, what is important to understand about this arrangement is this is not a temporary condition of the conflict. This is actually a strategic seizure of the Strait of Hormuz. By effectively closing the strait to some shipping and leaving it open to other shipping, Iran has effectively seized control over it. It's not just about they're lobbing drones over there and the whole thing is shut down. No, they are effectively exercising control like a tollway. And what has been made clear by Iran is that they are now going to formalize this new dynamic. This is going to actually become the long-term formal legal situation. And by that, I mean Iran aims to seize legal control over the strait, and in the future, they are going to charge every ship that enters and exits the strait a toll, which might be up to $2 million per ship. And this is not the way the Strait of Hormuz worked before. This is how other choke points work, like the Suez Canal or the Panama Canal, where Panama and Egypt will charge a toll for shipping the transits through that canal because they had to build the canal, because they have to maintain the canal. This is not how the Strait of Hormuz used to operate. So consider that Iran has actually expanded its control. So not only are we not getting what we originally asked for, and what we originally weren't even considering was on the table. So we're not getting nuclear restrictions, and we weren't even talking about missiles and regional proxies before. Now, they took the strait, and as we look toward a possible retreat or surrender, we're not even going to take that back. And so, when you look at this conflict, not only have we lost on the battlefield because we have not achieved our strategic objectives, actually, the opposite has happened. Iran has achieved strategic objectives. Not only did they survive and their regime is intact, what's more, many of their weapon systems are still intact. They still maintain the ability and what they claim to be their right to have a domestic drone and missile industry, to have nuclear enrichment, to have a nuclear complex. They still have that highly enriched uranium buried in one of their nuclear facilities, but also they're walking away with more than what they started with. Their oil industry remains intact. Their oil exports are actually still going through. And in the future, they're going to be able to turn the Strait of Hormuz into a revenue source And by seizing control over it, they now have de jure veto power over 20% of the world's oil supply. So you could say another way to frame that is that prior to the conflict, Iran produced 4% of the world's oil. So they controlled 4% of the world's oil. Well, now that they've taken control over the strait, through which 20% of the world's oil flows, now they have quintupled the amount of energy resources that they actually control. Whereas before they controlled the oil that they made and exported, which was 4%, now they control five times that because they get to dictate all the energy that goes through the strait, which is all the energy that is pumped from the Persian Gulf, not just from them, but also from the Gulf countries across the way. They also have now taken control over a fifth of the LNG market because it's 20% of the world's natural gas, which is being pumped out of Qatar through the Strait of Hormuz. So we are in a situation where, as we've said repeatedly throughout the past few weeks, Trump was not able to achieve his objectives. Iran survived the killing blow, and now they're not going anywhere because the attack failed. It has actually strengthened and buttressed the regime. And so we failed, they succeeded. And now Iran is inflicting the maximum amount of pain to deter future aggression, another attempt to topple their government. And not only that, but they have also taken control of the Strait of Hormuz in such a way that it might be impossible for us to undo this situation. And if we don't fix it now, we may never fix it because that would entail repeating this war, which would entail all the same problems that we're encountering now. A shortage of weapons, a shortage of munitions, the inability to suppress Iran's tactical capability to launch and make drones and ballistic missiles. So this is truly a dire situation. And as we've said, there's really just two options. Trump can either escalate or de-escalate. He can either ramp up the tactics, and the only way you can do that is with ground forces. We are doing everything that we are capable of in the air and from the sea. And so the only domain that we can actually even extend the fighting into is with some kind of ground presence. Whether that's an amphibious invasion, whether that's using a proxy force like the Kurds, whether we're backing an anti-government group on some timeline. That's the only way that we can escalate from a modal point of view, escalating the mode of fighting to achieve the initial objectives, which are regime change or disabling every position where they've hidden and are able to launch drones and missiles. The only other option is we sue for peace and we beg Iran for a truce through intermediaries like through Pakistan and China. And that's it. Those are your options. Now, as I said, the big development from today is that Trump appears to be looking for an exit. And that has been the story for the past few weeks. What is this exit going to consist in? Is Trump going to make some audacious invasion attempt, either of the islands or of the mainland, in an attempt to escalate in order to save face, gain leverage, dictate terms to end the conflict, or is Trump effectively just going to bow out and surrender? And the logic so far has been that it's unlikely that Trump will surrender. Based on what we know about Trump and his MO, based on what we know about the pressures in the region, our allies like Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and Israel, they want us to keep going and they're pressuring us to keep going. Based on the conditions in this conflict, if we wrap it up now, almost certainly this is going to become a problem again in the future. The leadership that we killed has been replaced by hardliners that are less willing to negotiate and more extreme. Because of the way we conducted ourselves in the conflict, we have probably alienated the Iranian people and made an uprising less likely, not more likely. Additionally, this war might be so catastrophic for the economy at a global level that if we even were to consider going back in and finishing the job, assuming that Iran tries to rebuild its missiles or nukes or other military capabilities, the entire world is going to protest a second go at it, a second attempt to try to do this all over again. And almost certainly, that is what the situation would call for on a long enough timeline, an emboldened regime that the people have rallied behind that is engaging to retake and rebuild its missile program, its highly enriched uranium, begin enriching uranium again. You're going to have pressure to go back in. So the wisdom so far has been that Trump is not going to walk away because really he can't. There's no way from a strategic point of view, it just isn't sound for us to just wash our hands of this and get out of it. On some level, Iran has all the cards and they are going to dictate how this is going to go. They're going to dictate the timeline and the terms. And there's very little that we can do to alter how they feel about it and how they're going to go about this. So like I said, you've got this statement from Trump earlier today. Trump says the war is going to end imminently. He's giving a statement tomorrow. You had Pete Hegseth say today that the next couple of days are going to be decisive. Marco Rubio said yesterday that we may end the conflict without liberating the Strait of Hormuz. Benjamin Netanyahu said to the Israeli press that Iran no longer poses a threat to Israel. And so over the past 48 hours, there's been this overwhelming messaging blitz. And that is how I would describe it. It looks very coordinated because of the timing and because the messaging is pretty consistent across the board. There is a messaging blitz which seems to want all of us to believe that this war is going to end. And this is what I hear everybody saying, and the markets seem to believe it as well. Today, all of the markets rebounded. I reposted it today in my Telegram. All the stock indices are up, the NASDAQ, S&P 500, the Dow, and they're way up. They were way down yesterday, way down on Friday. Today, everything's right back up. And the buzz and the rumors on social media is that the war is over. Bill Ackman is telling people to buy stocks again. Everything's going to be okay. And like I said at the top of the show, it might be the case, of course, that if we take this at face value, that this indicates that the war is truly about to end. And maybe Trump in the primetime address tomorrow will announce that the war is over and we will begin a withdrawal. There have been a lot of discussions to this end. What is Iran demanding on their side? Well, they have demanded that the U.S. withdraw from all of its Middle Eastern bases. There was a report just the other day that the United States wants to leave all of the Middle Eastern bases and they want to build a base in Israel to replace them. So maybe that points towards a surrender with honor. Maybe that points towards a face-saving withdrawal. Iran says that the new status quo is that they will control the Strait of Hormuz and charge a toll. Again, Trump has said and the Secretary of State has said that retaking the Strait of Hormuz is no longer necessary to end the war. Initially, when the war was declared, Trump said that one of the objectives was regime change. Well, just yesterday, Trump said we achieved regime change, even though that's not really true. Just like in Venezuela, the security infrastructure remains intact. The entire security apparatus is still there. It's still the Iranian Revolutionary Islamic Government. It's still the IRGC that runs the country. They appointed a new Ayatollah, and he is the son of the previous Ayatollah. And so there is not a meaningful regime change, and yet they're saying that it's mission accomplished, that victory condition has been satisfied. So there's a lot of evidence right now, again, just based on what is being said, how they are finessing the objectives, various rumors, statements, that maybe Washington is coming to peace with the fact that we can't win this one, that there's literally no way out. The air and sea power isn't doing it. And the longer this goes on, the more likely it will have catastrophic effects on the economy. And to the extent that they have considered some kind of amphibious assault of an island or the mainland, maybe they're reconsidering in light of the fact that it would be a suicide mission. It has a low likelihood of success. There would certainly be high casualties, whether it's successful or not. And that might actually tend to increase our commitment in this war rather than lead to a way out of it. So this is some of the logic that might suggest that we're leaving the war, and all the hype and all the buzz reflects an actual strategic pivot inside the White House. On the other hand, and this is where I've been coming at it from the past few weeks, I am deeply skeptical of everything that is being said by this administration right now, especially right now. And that is because the administration has a tendency to lie about everything. And in particular, the administration lies about matters of war. It's actually part of the doctrine. And it's been a part of Trump's doctrine since the very beginning, going back 10 years. Trump likes to put out a mixed message. He likes brinksmanship. He likes to offer the carrot and the stick. He likes to confuse and throw the opponent off balance. And so, actually, if you're taking it at face value, on its face, you almost have to assume that this is misdirection. It's almost a safer bet rather than assume they're telling the truth and they're telegraphing their real strategy. There is a pivot inside the White House and they're just telling us. I think actually maybe the more likely explanation is that it's misdirection. This is a case of tactical misdirection. And you know this because the messaging is very coordinated right now. And it's also a complete 180 from the messaging on Sunday. So while the Wall Street Journal is reporting that the insiders say that Trump is getting ready to wind down, he's bored with the fighting, he's ready to move on to Cuba, he's ready to resign without the Strait of Hormuz. On Sunday, Trump said that if Iran doesn't open up the strait, he's going to bomb all their civilian infrastructure. So how do you go from Sunday, if you don't open up the strait, we're going to nuke your country, to Monday, you know what, never mind, we're good. You keep the strait, we're not going to do anything at all. Simultaneously, there's been a lot of talk about diplomacy, about peace talks. And there has been this line for a week and a half, almost 2 weeks at this point. The administration is saying that they are in talks with intermediaries, Turkey, Pakistan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and they are trying to broker a truce with Iran. And to put it bluntly, Trump has just been lying about these negotiations since the beginning. Trump said that we are in talks with Iran. That's not true. We're not talking to Iran. We are passing messages through intermediaries, but there are no negotiations, there is no diplomacy, and there's not even direct contact. So that's a lie. Trump has said that Iran begged him to extend the deadline for the ultimatum. That's not true. Iran denies this. Trump went out last week and said that Iran agreed to every point in the 15-point plan that he proposed to them. None of that is true. Iran has their own plan, their own proposal to end the conflict, and it's almost the opposite of what Trump demanded. Trump is demanding surrender on every issue, and Iran is demanding that the U.S. pay them reparations, close all their bases, give them the Strait of Hormuz, and lift all the sanctions. So that's a lie as well. So you have to ask yourself, what accounts for the 180 in 24 hours? How did Trump go from there's all these deadlines, these rolling deadlines, Iran must open the strait or else? And the threats keep escalating, keep getting more severe. They have 48 hours or we attack the power grid. Actually, they have 5 more days. Actually, they have 10 more days. And actually, if they don't follow through, we'll bomb all the civilian infrastructure. How do you account for that? And if there's a diplomatic resolution to the conflict, why then is Trump lying about it every step of the way? And why is he lying about it seemingly to time the markets? Over the weekends, the rhetoric is bellicose. Over the weekend, the rhetoric is we're on a war footing. We're about to escalate. We're going to annihilate them. Then when the markets open on Monday, diplomacy is back and it seems like they're going to budge and we're already We're already there, basically. We've already made the deal. These are some of the things that Trump has said in the past week. Moreover, and this is the biggest one. So the White House is telegraphing that the war is about to come to a close. Well, if that's the case, why then is a third aircraft carrier headed to the Middle East right now? Do you know how much it costs to operate an aircraft carrier on a daily basis? It's like $15 million a day. And so you're going to have three carrier strike groups, the Lincoln, the Ford, and the George Bush, all in the Middle East. That is on top of the increase in our presence in the Middle East, 5,000 Marines, 5,000 paramilitary, and 10,000 other ground forces. Why are they being deployed to the region? So you have a 180. You've got the fake peace talks timed to coincide with the market opening and closing. And then you've actually got an increasing presence in the Middle East. You've actually got a bigger footprint, a bigger posture than you ever did at any time in the conflict. More carrier strike groups, more troops, Marines ready to go. So what are we to make of all this? Well, as I've said over the past few weeks, if we take history as a guide, every time that we have dealt with Iran, or even Iran's proxies for that matter, like Hezbollah or Hamas, it seems that the peace agreements are always a ruse. The negotiations are always a fake out. Last year, were Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner actually seeking a real nuclear deal? I don't know that they really were. I do know that those peace talks began the day that Netanyahu visited the White House. And after the 60 days expired, it gave Israel and the United States time to plan and to time to create the favorable conditions for their attack against Iran in Rising Lion and Midnight Hammer last June. The same thing happened this year. The White House engaged Iran in negotiations, and the entire time they were moving 50% of our deployable air force to the Middle East, moving two carrier strike groups to the Middle East. And so is this time any different? This is, to me, deja vu all over again. It's more talk of negotiations, more talk of diplomacy. And the headlines and the lead always talks about how positive things are going. It's productive. It's constructive. Both sides walked away pleased with their progress. It always goes that way. But upon further inspection, when you look at the deployments that are happening, upon further inspection, when you look at the two positions of either side in the negotiation, what you realize is the talks are not making any progress at all. They're not making any progress towards each other. They both have the red lines, and they're both sticking to them. Okay, our $100 a month club is spamming the group chat because it just turned midnight on April Fool's Day. Very good. I'm just going to turn Do Not Disturb on. That's hilarious. Making me lose my... I'm literally getting 500 messages from the group chat. April Fool's, very, very funny. So as I said, if history is our judge, the way this plays out over and over and over again is that you have these negotiations, they're a farce, and they are a farce that gives the United States breathing room to plan and execute and mobilize a military strike. It seems like maybe that's the play all over again, but it could go either way. It's hard to tell right now. We are in the fog of war, and honestly, nobody knows, other than the president, other than the national security team, whether we are going to withdraw immediately or whether we're going to escalate and we're going to try some sort of amphibious landing. The last piece of information in the puzzle is these other countries that are involved in this. And so ostensibly, we are negotiating with Iran through intermediaries like Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Turkey. But consider that many of these countries, at least one of these countries, is actively seeking Iran's destruction. Although initially, some of these countries were reluctant to support our war in Iran, now they are the biggest cheerleaders. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Kuwait, all of these countries are now lobbying Washington that they want us to continue the war, They want us to continue until the Iranian regime is toppled. And they're telling us we can't leave until we finish the job. Now, and this was reported today, the United Arab Emirates has pledged that they will actually intervene in the conflict in an offensive way. They may support the United States with their air force. They may provide territory for the United States as a staging ground to invade some of the islands in the Strait of Hormuz and the Persian Gulf. And this is a story from the Wall Street Journal about that. It says, quote, the UAE is preparing to help the United States and other allies open the Strait of Hormuz by force, say Arab officials, a move that would make it the first Persian Gulf country to become a combatant. The UAE is lobbying for a UN Security Council resolution that would authorize such action. Emirati diplomats have urged the U.S. and military powers in Europe and Asia to form a coalition to open the strait by force. The UAE official said the country was actively reviewing how it could play a military role in securing the strait, including efforts to help clear it of mines and other support services. The Gulf state has also said the U.S. should occupy islands in the strategic waterway, including Abu Musa, which has been held by Iran for a half century and is claimed by the UAE. Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states are now turning against Iran's regime and want the war to continue until it is disabled or toppled. The UAE has bases, a deep water port, and a location near the entrance to the Strait of Hormuz that could be useful staging grounds for a U.S.-led operation to seize islands or to escort commercial tankers through the waterway. Now, what is interesting about this is if you were paying attention, last week, Iran's parliamentary speaker went to the press and said he knows that the U.S. is preparing an amphibious invasion. He also said he knows that one of the Gulf countries will be assisting in the invasion. And he said that Iran would punish that country, would not spare any of their critical infrastructure. Well, does that not line up with what is happening? When you look at the Western press, when you look at the American press, what are they saying? Well, the American press is saying the war is about to end. Trump is looking for a way out. They're saying 2 to 3 weeks. They have canceled their plans to invade because that goes beyond their 2 to 3 week deadline. Trump is getting bored. He wants to move on. So-and-so said this. An unnamed source said that. This is in the Western media. They're saying there's peace talks, diplomacy. Trump is brokering a deal through intermediaries. They're willing to leave without taking the strait back. But if you look at what Iran has been saying, Iran has been saying the entire time, we're not negotiating with the United States and we don't want to. They're saying this isn't even the time to end the war. The war is going to go on until we say it stops. So forget about we're in negotiations. Iran is telling us they're not even interested in negotiations. They're telling us they don't trust us. They're telling us the 15-point plan is a non-starter for negotiations. They're telling us, forget it. You tried to kill us. You failed. Now you want to sue for peace? We don't think so. We want to make it hurt a little bit longer. So Iran is calling BS on that. When Trump extended the deadline and said that Iran begged for this, Iran said that's a lie. Trump only said that because he wants to reassure the oil market in the United States, which is probably true as well. And while the entire Western media is telegraphing that the war is about to end, Iran has been saying since last week they are anticipating an amphibious assault with the UAE helping them. And it's reported today with all this fanfare about an imminent surrender that the UAE, not only do they not want the war to end, but actually they're going to help. Actually, they're going to allow us to use their territory. They may even provide their air force to help us topple the government. And so, as I said, this could go either way. This is the fog of war, and this is a disinformation strategy. They are flooding the zone with mixed signals because they want everybody to be off balance. And as I said last night, they want everybody to be off balance. They want Iran to not know the next move. If we're going to invade, they want Iran not to anticipate that. But they're also trying to deceive the Gulf countries. And they're trying to convince the Gulf countries that if they don't provide more assistance, we will abandon this project, which they believe will be very beneficial for them. and we're bluffing to Asia and Europe that we will end the conflict without freeing the Strait of Hormuz to put pressure on them to help us in this military operation. And I think the only way that you can consider all of this information is this is a deliberate misinformation strategy. This is part of the conduct of the war in itself. And this is meant to leverage the different pieces that are in place. Trump wants Europe and Asia to help him. He wants the Gulf countries to play a bigger role. He wants buy-in from these nations because he knows that if Iran isolates Israel and the United States, then we lose. If Iran can negotiate with every other country and get these oil products out to sea and sell the oil and collect their toll, then they won. And if the United States is not able to topple the regime without a ground war, well, the pressure is only going to mount in the United States against the conflict. They've won that too. So this is the current predicament that we find ourselves in. And I would not be surprised if we get an invasion this weekend. If I had to make a prediction, if I had to, and I don't want to, because it really, I want to stress it could go either way. I think the sensible thing at this point would be to leave and turn our attention to Israel. How did we get in this conflict? Well, apparently Israel forced our hand. I don't think a deal with Iran is impossible, but it is impossible if Israel is sabotaging it as a matter of their grand strategy. If their doctrine is fundamentally about undermining diplomacy between Iran and the United States, then yes, a deal is impossible. But if we can push Israel outside the process while we build trust over time and negotiate with a weakened but emboldened Iran, it's possible we can achieve diplomacy. But first, we have to take care of closest ally. That being said, if I had to make a prediction, I would guess tomorrow is more theater. I would guess that tomorrow is a big fake out. It's April Fool's. I think that Trump is going to go out there. He's going to tout all of his accomplishments. All the MAGA-tards are going to say that it's 4D chess. Trump said he was going to give a primetime speech and trolled the media into covering him, brag about his presidency. I think he's going to extol everything we've done in the war. But I don't think he's going to end the hostilities. I think it might be a big nothing burger. And I would not be surprised if by the weekend, which is just shy of the deadline. Again, Trump gave the ultimatum on Friday that they have until, or pardon me, on Thursday. Trump gave them the deadline of April 6th. So they have until Monday when the markets open again. And so when we fit all the timelines together, Trump's deadline, the market open on Monday, the arrival of the Marine Expeditionary Unit, the paratroopers, the third carrier, all this fanfare surrounding a peace deal or a withdrawal from the conflict, it all points toward potentially a major escalation by the end of this week, at the minimum, at the end of this weekend. And what Pete Hegseth said this morning specifically is he said the next few days are going to be the most decisive days in the war. Well, what is that? If we're about to declare a surrender, then what does that mean? If we're about to surrender, then why do you need another carrier strike group? And why would it be decisive in the final day, if that's the case? And why would Trump be re-upping the deadline still? Why would he make the threat on Sunday to destroy their infrastructure if by Wednesday he's ready to resign? It doesn't add up. And what it points toward is they are bluffing, trying to get every resource they can to get buy-in from other countries. They want, if Iran is going to go to war with the global energy market, we want Iran to really own it. We're sort of calling their bluff. Okay, Iran wants to make energy more expensive for everybody because they're going to hold the Strait hostage with drones and missiles. Well, try that with the British Royal Navy. Try that with the French Navy. Try that with Japan, South Korea, India. He wants to draw in the other countries so that they are stakeholders, because then that puts Iran in a much more isolating position, where if they are going to follow through on their closure of the strait, it now forces them into a confrontation with all the other G7 countries. Now you're not just bombing the United States and Israel and these Gulf countries, but now you're also bombing the UK, France, Japan, India, South Korea. And all this talk about we're going to leave without closing the strait. It makes sense when you consider that, again, that is going to hit Asia first, Europe second, and it's only going to hurt us in terms of price. Who's going to have an energy shortage in 2 weeks? Malaysia, maybe India, maybe China, South Korea, Japan. They're going to face it first. And then who's going to start rationing jet fuel and other fossil fuel products? Europe. We'll do it right after that. And then at the very end of the chain is going to be the United States, which is going to deal with some mild inflation. And it might be disastrous. It might pop the AI bubble. It might cause a recession, but it's going to happen to us at the end of the cycle rather than the beginning. And that's clearly the bluff. We're going to leave without opening the strait. And whose problem is that really going to be? Well, that's a you problem for now. And what is left unsaid is, well, but if you help us, then maybe we can help you. If you contribute your Navy, if you contribute in some way, then we'll help you. And he's saying the same thing effectively to the UAE and KSA. He's telling the Saudis and the Emiratis, look, you want us to topple Iran? Well, our back hurts. We're ready to leave. And if you want to go in, then you go in. You want to take back those islands? Then we need your territory. We need your air power. Maybe we need your boots on the ground. But it seems to be that all of this is one giant messaging op. I've seen it everywhere all day today. Well, but Lindsey Graham says the war should end. Oh, well, Netanyahu says Iran doesn't pose a threat. Well, quite honestly, we've heard all this before. We've heard all these statements before. And I think it doesn't change the reality on the ground, which is that we're still fighting. We're deploying more assets, not withdrawing them. And I will add, they made it a point to say that Iran has fired the least amount of projectiles since the beginning of the war. Maybe that has some bearing on the potential success of an amphibious assault. The only thing that is deterring the U.S. Navy from entering the Persian Gulf is we're afraid that Iran will hit us with a missile or a drone. And the only reason that it is a very high risk, high reward operation to take Karg Island or one of the other islands is because we know those islands will be bombarded by missiles and drones. Well, if we have intelligence that Iran is running out, if they have launched fewer missiles today than ever before and it's tapering off all the time, then maybe the idea is they just don't have enough weapons to deter this. And this is what we need. To end the war, we need to save face. We need some dignity. How do we do that? We need a win. What can we do that we haven't done? Well, we can't invade on the ground, on the mainland. Maybe we can take an island. Oh, well, you'll never get to the island because of the drones and missiles. Well, not if you prepare for 3 weeks. Not if you bomb Karg Island's military assets. Not if you move missile defense systems into place. Not if you move the attack helicopters into place. And if Iran runs out of drones and missiles or is running low, then the attack helicopters will have an easier job shooting them down. And your concentrated layered air defense system will have an easier job shooting down Iranian missiles. And that allows the Marines to land, make a beachhead, repair the runway, repair the other facilities, and then they can begin flying in the paratroopers and the other ground forces. They can say mission accomplished. And then maybe they can dictate terms to Iran. And I think that might be the playbook here. But it's hard to say because we're being told both things at the same time. At once we're being told Iran is under a deadline. The pressure is on. They have until Monday. On the one hand, they're telling us the Pentagon has put 10,000 soldiers on notice. They're telling Marine reservists to get ready to go to war. Iran is denying the existence of peace talks. It goes on and on and on like this. So I refuse to believe that they're telling the truth and the war is about to end. However, I hope that this happens. So that's the unfolding situation in the war. Like I said, there's really not too much to cover tonight. I guess we'll move on. We'll talk a little bit about the East Wing of the White House, although it's not too exciting. And you've already basically heard it, but it's a really short show. Not too much going on. What more is there really to say? We sort of know where all of this is headed. But our final story, and then we'll get into the super chats, is a story about the White House. And again, this is not a major news story, but it just goes to show It's another taco. Trump always chickens out on everything. And I'll actually add something to this, which makes it even better. So, as you know, President Trump has demolished the East Wing of the White House. Why? Well, he believes the White House doesn't have an adequate and a regal ballroom. When foreign leaders visit the White House, there is no dedicated area to receive them. And so the only spaces they have for a proper event are pretty small and dingy. So Trump wants to host. He wants to be he wants to host big parties and bring people around. He wants to have an adequate Mar-a-Lago Trump Tower-esque space where he can invite Putin and Xi Jinping and not feel totally outclassed by these other dictators. So Trump has demolished the East Wing, and he is now building a giant structure on the White House to house this massive ballroom. Well, the big story from today is that we are very thoroughly into the process. Trump has demolished the East Wing, this historic East Wing. I think it's been around for about 70, 100 years. Trump has demolished the East Wing. They're building this unbelievable structure. Apparently, there's going to be some kind of military command center underneath, and then there's going to be a giant structure that's bigger than the actual White House on top of it. And today, a federal judge filed an injunction that prevents Trump from moving forward on the plan. And this is a story from Axios. It says, quote, a federal judge on Tuesday temporarily blocked President Trump's sprawling plans to build a massive ballroom where the East Wing of the White House once stood. U.S. District Judge Richard Leon said Trump is the steward, not the owner of the White House, and that the project must stop until Congress authorizes its completion. Leon granted the National Trust for Historic Preservation's request for a preliminary injunction halting the administration's fast-track plan. The trust has argued that the White House needs congressional approval for the extensive renovation and said in a filing earlier this month that the president is a temporary tenant of the White House, its steward, not its landlord. The National Trust sued the president and other federal agencies, arguing the demolition violated the Constitution and asked the judge to block construction until a required review process. The complaint said, quote, no president is legally allowed to tear down portions of the White House without any review whatsoever, not Trump, not Biden, and not anyone else. And this is sort of symbolic. Isn't this sort of symbolic of all of it? Trump is like the supervillain in Jimmy Neutron who can never finish anything. It's like a half-eaten sandwich, a half-eaten thing over here, half-finished project over there. Like, what honestly is going on? So Trump does the Liberation Day tariffs. Liberation Day is coming. We're going to change everything. We're going to overthrow the international trade order. And it's like they crammed all of it an hour before the deadline. Then they came out with the formula for the tariffs, and it was this very crude algorithm. It was like a linear equation, how they determined the actual tariff rate for every country on planet Earth. It wasn't by sector. It wasn't by product. It was just a formula based on what percentage of imports and exports they had. And they had to walk it back. And then there was Greenland. We're going to invade Greenland. We have to have it. NATO put a half dozen troops there. We said, you know what? Never mind. We're good. We go all out in a war with Iran, literally telling everybody we're going to war for regime change. They have been a problem for 47 years. That comes to an end. We're going to kill their leader, do everything. And then they take the Strait of Hormuz and there's nothing we can do. It's like everything is like this. And then Trump tears down the East Wing. It's a total eyesore. He destroys one third of the White House. And only a year in, a federal judge comes in and says, you know, that's not technically legal. What you're doing is not. So now we just have a destroyed White House. And this is kind of how this whole administration is, which is we are playing a very dangerous game. It's very destructive. There's a ton of collateral damage and casualties. If we fail, we die. And yet, all of this is being undertaken in a totally ad hoc and spontaneous way. Before you tear down the White House, you don't want to get the permits in order? You didn't ask Congress? Yeah, let's just blow up the White House first, then ask questions later. FBI, I mean like what Trump is doing. Let's demolish the East Wing of the White House first, and we'll figure the legal stuff out later. Let's kill the Supreme Leader of Iran first. Maybe they'll close the strait. They probably won't. We'll figure that out later. Everything is like this. And even, this is the other thing I wanted to add. At the same time that this decision was made, you have a Supreme Court decision coming down on birthright citizenship. You ready for this? So a year ago, during the blitz of the opening months of the second Trump administration, during the high period of the golden age, in the era of the high golden age, in the first 2 or 3 months of the Trump administration, Trump signed an executive order overturning birthright citizenship. It was hailed as a victory. Everybody said, this is amazing. See, we can just do things. We're wielding executive power. We could just do things. And this is why you needed to trust the plan, because now Trump has overturned birthright citizenship, and that's the most important thing of all time. And you go, do you really believe that the president of the United States can sign a memorandum? Because that's really what an executive order is. It's a memorandum. It's a memo. The executive branch has no legislative power other than to veto. They can propose a budget. They can veto legislation. They can nominate Supreme Court judges and nominate cabinet officials. But as far as the legislative process is concerned, the legislation originates in Congress. So what an executive order is it's an MO. Who is it addressed to? The departments and agencies that execute the laws that are passed by Congress. Legislative, executive, judicial. The legislative legislates. The executive executes. The judicial adjudicates. So the president cannot make laws, cannot change laws. What the president can do is sign memorandums that determine the application and enforcement of the laws by the various federal departments and agencies. Now, do you believe that Trump has the authority with a memo to deprive, I don't know, 20 million people of their citizenship, however many people it is? How many people have birthright citizenship? How many people have naturalization because they were born on the land? Does anybody believe that Trump can sign a memo and take all that citizenship away for all those people? Obviously, that's not legal. But Trump submitted that last year, and everybody counted that like a victory. Everybody said, oh, well, we did it, so that's done now. That's on the ledger. That's a good thing that Trump did. Well, here we are now. The Supreme Court is adjudicating this, and they're about to tell us that no, you can't overturn birthright citizenship. Trump is on True Social yesterday saying the Supreme Court is terrible because he's anticipating that they're going to strike it down. He's actually going to hear the oral arguments in court tomorrow. And so you say at a certain point, how much losing is enough on every issue, literally every issue, big and small, significant and insignificant, every issue. It's a taco. Maybe that's why I'm a specialist. Maybe that's why you need a Mexican to come in and discern these things. Because every issue is a taco. Trump always chickens out. Chickens out on Greenland, on tariffs, on Russia, on Iran, on the Strait of Hormuz. Chickens out with the European Union. Chickens out with the East Wing of the White House on mass deportations, on birthright citizenship. On the border wall. It's literally every single thing. And who cares? But here's the point about all of it. This is why I didn't want Trump to win, because a half-assed dictator is worse. There's no such thing as a half-ass coup. You can't coup the hegemonic left-wing system and go halfway. You can't be like Trump and say, mass deportations, we're going to arrest our opponents, we're going to seize control of the voter rolls. You can't say all these things and try to do all these things and only get halfway and give up. You can't start that, open up that can of worms. You're arresting James Comey. You're arresting these judges. You're suing the media. You destroy the White House. Destroy the White House. And then halfway through go, you know what? Never mind. We didn't plan for this. You know what? Never mind. We didn't think it through. Can we go back? The tariffs got overturned. Birthright citizenship, executive order got overturned. Mass deportations, they backed down. Greenland, they backed down. China, they everything they backed down. And do you know what happens when you go all the way or try and you fail? Well, the people that you tried to kill, they tend to then, in turn, kill you. That is what happens. If you go for the king, you better kill him. If you go for the king, you better not miss. You want to know why? Because if you take a shot and you miss, there's a very good chance the king turns around and kills you. Because kings don't like when you try to kill them. And that is really what the Trump movement is. That is what the second term, that is how you can summarize the entire thing. Half measures on everything. Half measures against Iran, half measures against free trade, against immigration. And all this is going to do is charge up the pendulum. That's all we're doing. We are just sending energy and momentum to the pendulum, to this wrecking ball that is going to swing so hard the other way, it's going to bury us for a generation. Honest to God, I'm leaving the country. If, or more likely when, a Democrat wins in 2028, I'm leaving America. And when I say that, I don't mean like I'm leaving America because like I don't like the way things are going. I mean, they're going to try to kill us. That's what I mean, they're going to try to kill us. And they're not hiding it. J.B. Pritzker, the governor of Illinois, said, when we get in, we're going to hold everybody liable. Excuse me, he said, not criminally, but civilly. We're going to hold everybody that was a part of this thing liable. And not just the government employees. We're going after everybody. I'm not sticking around to find out what an Anthropic-powered, Obama, you know, dark woke agenda is going to look like. I'm going to flee the country. I'm going to see how it shakes out. I'm going to monitor the situation. And I saw there's some plan trusters out there and they're saying, well, you know, the problem is you don't want to be all in. Like you're shying away from Trump because you're getting cold feet and you don't want to take the fight to the left. And you know what? That's 100% true. I saw a John Doyle video about this the other day. John Doyle said, if you find yourself criticizing Trump, pandering to the left, he said, this is about you getting cold feet and you want out of the fight. And it's like, yeah, I am. I am not on the suicide mission with Trump. You know, Gavin Newsom, if you can hear me, I'm not with him. Gavin Newsom, he's over there. He went that way. He did it. Don't look at me. I voted for Hitler. Trump went that way. Get him, Gavin. I'm over. And you want to know why? Because everyone with a brain knew that Trump was not a fucking serious person. If Trump were serious, okay, I would ride. If Trump were legit, bro, my heart goes out to him. If Trump were a legit Caesar Augustus figure, dude, send the army. My heart goes out to you. I'm there. And you know, death penalty, bring it forth. Like, and we will do whatever we want to them. But we all knew that Trump is not serious. Trump is not competent. His team are idiots or scammers or Jews, I repeat myself, or they're incompetent. He is terrible. His people are terrible. And we saw this movie before. So part of the reason why I told people not to vote and why I thought maybe Kamala would be better is because we know that Trump, like before, is barking up the wrong tree. He is calling out and attacking the most powerful people in the world, or working with them in some cases, but with zero willingness or ability to actually defeat them or finish the job. He doesn't cross the Rubicon and march on Rome and do what must be done. He goes in the Rubicon and kind of hangs out in there. And he chills out on Truth Social and says, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. Never mind. Actually, we're good. Actually, what I meant is that we won the whole time. And if you play that way, then we're all going to die. So you're damn right. You're damn right. I am not repeating the mistake of the first term. And here's the difference. I was actually at January 6th. I was actually at Charlottesville. Let me tell you something. I sacrificed a lot for this movement. A lot. I went to Charlottesville and got my life destroyed. I wore a MAGA hat everywhere and became a social pariah and professionally ostracized. And I did the stupid internet show and I bought into all the nonsense about immigration and the bro science and the conspiracy theories and all this crap. And when Trump said the election was stolen, I showed up to the rallies, Stop the Steal. And I showed up on January 6th and I got royally fucked all over again. I got my money frozen. I got put on the no-fly list. I got censored. Trump didn't do a damn thing to help anybody. Didn't pardon everybody when he had the chance to in 2021. He didn't lift a finger to stop tech censorship when he was president the first time. And all the people that campaigned and volunteered for him, one by one, he threw them under the bus. And they weren't even hired in the administration, or they were allowed to be ostracized by people that hate Trump. I learned my lesson. And I said, I'm not doing it again. I'm not riding for this guy. Look at what happened. We knocked on the doors. We wore the stupid hat. People got fired from their jobs, got their asses kicked, got banned on Twitter, got banned on Uber for this guy. People went to the Stop the Steal rallies, got imprisoned for this guy because he asked us to. He asked us to show up. And you know what happened on J6th? He fucked around. On J6th, he could have went and said, I'm going to the Capitol and I'm not leaving. He didn't do that. He waited too long. He let everybody storm the Capitol. Then hours later, he said, you know what? Never mind. Forget it. I'm going to go home like a good boy. And then everyone went to jail for 5 years. And now we're doing it all over again. And look at what Trump is doing. He blew up the White House. You got these ICE raids, and they're literally doing them performatively just to piss off the left. Charlie Kirk is dead. He got shot in the face. What has Charlie Kirk profited from this movement? Charlie Kirk got shot in the face because he is a lieutenant of the MAGA movement, and Trump didn't even give a shit. He got shot in the fucking head. And they said, what do you think about your friend Charlie Kirk being assassinated today? And he said, oh, it's bad. Anyway, if you look at the East Wing, we're doing an amazing job. So I just learned my lesson and I said, no, I'm not committing suicide for this movement. It's not going to work. And if it's not going to work, then I'm not going to be a part of it because I'm not going to put all that back on the line for a movement that isn't serious. You want supporters, you want loyalty, you got to take it seriously. You got to play to win. You got to be all in it. You can't be selling Trump coin. You can't be doing a Melania feature film in the theaters. You can't be cutting deals like that. You can't be getting an airplane from Qatar and doing all the graft and embezzlement that's going on and expecting everybody to go out and cape for this stuff. I don't want to be there when Antifa starts cutting everybody's heads off. You're damn right. You're damn right. We're going to say, hey, we're not with Trump. Absolutely. Absolutely. So like I said, if Gavin Newsom is looking for Trump, I'm going to tell him where he is. Forget it. Forget it. It's a two-way street. That's what I see with this White House thing with the birthright citizenship. It's just like, at what point do you realize you got scammed? You got promised a bunch of things they never intended to deliver. And you know they never intended to do it because it's not serious. It's not serious. They're embarking on all these things without doing their due diligence. It's not airtight. These are all unforced errors. And what you're left with is idiots picking up the pieces and trying to find catharsis on Twitter, saying he squandered our coalition. Bro, he don't give a shit about the coalition. You do. He wipes his ass with the coalition that you're crying about. He is literally, when he is telling people, if you still care about the Epstein files, I don't need your vote. He's wiping his ass with the coalition that you're crying about, you're clinging to, you're hugging and kissing. I can't believe this coalition, we were really going to do it. It was going to be a golden age and we were going to have deportations. And Trump goes, deportations? How about a war with Iran? The sooner you learn this, the better.